I do want to take time to think about the days of unleavened bread. Now, as was brought out in the sermonette, these feasts have everything to do with Jesus Christ. And every feast pictures the love of our Father that He has shown through Jesus Christ. Every feast pictures God's love and salvation through Jesus Christ. And the days of unleavened bread are exactly the same. We can see easily Jesus Christ is our Passover. And we think about that. I mean, when we go to the book of 1 Corinthians, and I know of no book that is read more often during the days of unleavened bread than the book of 1 Corinthians, because it tells us about the Passover in chapter 11, tells us how to keep it. Think about this. If there were not 1 Corinthians 11, how many of us would have this week killed a lamb and roasted it? There's absolutely no place else in the Bible that says that that is done away other than 1 Corinthians 11. I mean, it says this is not to eat the Lord's Supper, but we would be eating the Lord's Supper if it weren't for Paul saying that. So I'm so glad that we have 1 Corinthians 11. Now we have other places that tell the meaning of the Passover and the meaning of the lamb and what it is like, but that just gives a nice synopsis right there in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And if you go before that to chapter 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, chapter 8, 9, and 10 are all together. If you just look at each chapter by itself, you wouldn't know that chapter 9 is part of three chapters, 8, 9, and 10. It all has to do with eating meat offered to idols, which some in Corinth were beginning to do, saying, oh, there's no problem with eating. I know that the temple's nothing, and I know that that this idol of the, is nothing, means nothing. So he starts out in chapter 8 and then goes through chapter 9. Basically, chapter 9 is just saying, there are a lot of things that are legal for me to do as an apostle, but I don't have to do them. His point is, yeah, you may know that meat offered to an idol isn't literally defiled, it's symbolically defiled, but you just don't have to do everything you think is legal. But then in chapter 10, he really hits it hard when he says, when you eat what is offered to an idol, you're eating what is offered to demons. And I would not have you take of demons and the plate of God also. So that's in chapter 10. See, the things which this, verse 20, the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons. But there's also in chapter 10 some lessons that were a lesson not directly that he was working on, but he was warning them in chapter 10. And we also read verse 16 and 17. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is not the communion of the body of Christ? His point is, if you're taking things offered to idols, you're having communion with a demon. So he brings this up, and then he says that. But beginning of chapter 10 also gives us some lessons and makes me think of something that I like to do right beginning after the Passover, and that is to begin reading about the Israelites going into the wilderness and all the troubles they got into. And he says those are good lessons that we have. See, he's warning them at the beginning of chapter 10, all right, you think you're so smart, you think you've come through the Red Sea, you think you've had baptism, watch out. Don't be like the Israelites. Don't be eating meat offered to idols, is what he's going to eventually get to in this chapter. But it's a lesson for us where chapter 10, verse 1, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So he's warning them, you think you have Christ, you think you're following him. He's going to get down and finally say, well, you do not want to have the drink and the food of demons, of an idol. And he's warning them before he gets to it. See, the real heart of chapters 8, 9, and 10 is later on toward the end of chapter 10. That's his point that he's working toward. And he begins to warn them. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. Even though they were taking the food and the spiritual drink that was Christ. He wasn't pleased. In verse 6, these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And then he mentions some specifics of what happened in the wilderness. And he says, verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands, he's talking to these people who think they have special knowledge that it's okay for them to eat meat that's been offered to an idol. Paul says, don't ask, but if you know, don't eat. If you know it's been offered. But he says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. And so then he goes in to finish up his point. Here's where he was working toward, beginning in verse 14. Flee from idolatry. And then he warns about the demons. So there's another spot. But also chapter 5, we're familiar with it. And this is all often read about the days of unleavened bread. And a lot of commentators feel that this book was written just during or very much around the days of unleavened bread and the Passover. Because in chapter 5, verse 1, he's warning about another problem. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. There it is. This was probably a stepmother, because it didn't say his mother. And you are puffed up. That's an interesting statement right there, puffed. Notice in English, the word puff. You've got that nice P sound, puff. You can just almost see it. And the Greek doesn't have the hard P, but it's fusio, fus. See? Puff, fus. Doesn't have the hard P, but it has a soft P, fus. Sort of a PH sound at the beginning. And it's only used, that Greek word is only used 7 times in the Bible. 6 of those times are right here in the book of 1 Corinthians. The other one is in Colossians chapter 2, verse 18. But it's used right here in this book where it's talking about being puffed up. Why some think this is really such a good book for the days of unleavened bread. Because what is leavened bread? It's bread that's been puffed up. And we're to be learning not to be puffed up. unleavened bread pictured Jesus Christ. We take unleavened bread with the Passover because he was not puffed up. If you take a pound of dough and you bake flatbread with it, it's going to weigh a pound. If you put leavening in it and it puffs up, it is still going to weigh a pound. Now, it isn't that air doesn't have mass and weight. It does. But since the atmosphere and what's in the bread is under the same pressure, it makes no difference. By the way, the question is asked, and you should know this, if you take a basketball and it's flat and you weigh it, and then you you pressurize it, it'll weigh more. Now, there's no pressure, same pressure as the atmosphere, it won't weigh more. But as soon as you start putting, because you're putting more air, and air does have weight, doesn't seem like it because it's all the same pressure around us. But how many of you remembered that? Did you have that experiment when you were in physics or chemistry in high school? You did? Okay. It was a balloon. And you weighed it before and after. Did they weigh it? I wouldn't. Okay. If you blow it up, you put pressure on that basketball, it's going to weigh more. Now, all of you can go home, check that out if you have a basketball, right? It won't weigh a lot more, but it will weigh a little more. But bread won't, because it's the same pressure. How many of you, when you were young and your mom had white bread, would take on the white bread the crust off, mash up the dough, and then bounce it on the wall? How many of you, a few of you did that? Okay. Can't do it as easily with whole wheat, or whole grain, but you could with white. I mean, it's just puff. That's all. It's empty. It looks like it's more. And that's what we as human beings are. We're puffed up. Jesus was not puffed up. We've all seen people who just, actually we've all seen people like this in the mirror, but who are puffed up a little bit. Pride is like a pack of wild African dogs. They're just right behind us. And if we slow down spiritually at all, they'll grab us and eat us up. We all fight pride. Very difficult to seek humility. Very difficult thing on our own. We can't. But anyway, he says, you are puffed up. You have fusiel. And have not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. For I indeed, as absent in body but present in spirit, have already judged as though I were present concerning him who has so done this deed. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together along with my spirit with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, to deliver, deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Your glorying, that's the puff up, that's part of what we're to learn every day, that we, as we eat that flat bread, that is Jesus, that's his example, and that's what we are learning, that we've coming out of this world, out of the pride of this world, out of Satan's world, and that we have to be humbled, to be humbled. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? It will spread. Some sins spread. Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. If you read commentaries, it'll be different. They may give more than one explanation for where it says, since you truly are unleavened, as to whether that's spiritual leaven Or were they at that moment still physically unleavened? Were they physically unleavened? For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. That they weren't spiritually unleavened, but they had physically unleavened themselves. Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, that is humble, that sincere, that what you see is what you get, that there isn't this puffiness within us. By the way, three of the times that this word, this Greek word is used is in the previous chapter. And if you look at chapter 4, verse 6, you'll see one of the places. He says that they were looking to men. And some are saying, I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Paul, and I'm of this other Cephas. And he says, verse 6, now these things, brethren, chapter 4, verse 6, I have figuratively transferred to myself and Apollos, for your sakes, that you may learn in us not to think beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up. My margin has arrogant for many of these spots. On behalf of one another, two of the other locations, verse 18 and 19 of chapter 4. Now some are puffed up as though I were not coming to you. But I will come to you shortly if the Lord wills, and I will know not the word of those who are puffed up, but the power. I haven't given the title, but I will in a moment. But I want to look at chapter 8 and verse 1. This is the beginning of his 3-chapter lesson on not going into idols' temples and eating there. Even though you might say, well, the temple is nothing and the idol is nothing. It's just a, but he's saying, he finally in chapter 10 says, no, wait a second. There are demons involved around that idol. They're worshiping a demon, one of the gods of this world. So chapter 8, verse 1 is an interesting statement that will have to do with the point that I would like to make today with the days of unleavened bread. Now, concerning things offered to idols. See, this is opening up his point of these 3 chapters till he gets down toward the end of chapter 10 where he says, you are not to be doing this, you're eating the table of demons. Now, concerning things offered to idols. We know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge, and here's the word phusieo, knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. Edifies means builds up. You're building somebody else up. Knowledge can puff me up. After all, how many of us knew that if you took a basketball and blew it up, they'd weigh more, see? Wow, that and what a few dollars, I could get a cup of coffee somewhere. It's pretty much you could live your whole life, right? And never know that and be in God's kingdom. Never know that. Just useless knowledge, I guess. We all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies or builds up. It builds up the other person. Love builds it up. By the way, another one, while I'm here, knowledge puffs up. One of the other places it's used is in chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 4. And this shows what really is important. Love builds up. It builds the other person. Pride builds ourselves up. We're exalting ourselves. Love is building up the other person. And that's why he says here in verse 4, love suffers. This is called the love chapter. A lot of people call it the love chapter. Love suffers long and is kind. 1 Corinthians 13:4. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. Is not puffed up. Is not puffed up. That's part of the lesson that we have during the days of unleavened bread as we examine ourselves, is to seek humility, is to seek to be flat, to be humble, and examine ourselves in that way. But there is also the lesson that we have that the bread, that when it's puffed up, adds nothing to your nutrition. It's soft. It may be pleasant. You may like puffed up bread. You may enjoy it for a sandwich. You may want it for your hamburger. It may be pleasant to taste, but it adds absolutely no nutrition. Unless you might say, well, the yeast adds a little nutrition. Okay, I'll grant you that. But basically, the air that's in there, the carbon dioxide that got trapped in it, adds no nutrition at all. Not even a little bit. It just doesn't add any nutrition. And we need to look at that and say, you know, there's a lot in life. There's a lot in life that is just meaningless. Things that we like. Things that we care about. But it just ends up being meaningless. And Solomon brought that out in the book of Ecclesiastes. I'd like to at least go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. I did not understand the meaning of vanity when I was young. Now, I thought it was synonymous with conceit and ego and being puffed up was vanity. But actually, and those things are conceit, ego, being puffed up like a toad. Those things are vanity. But there are things that are vanity that are not necessarily conceit. There are other things. Because he says everything is vanity when you look at this. And through here, by the way, we had an excellent, I only heard the second one and I haven't gone through it. David Horvath gave an excellent pair of sermons on the book of Ecclesiastes. And he counted how many times Solomon talked about just himself, saying, I, me, my, and compared that with David's Psalms, where he used I, me, my very little, but it was always glorifying God. Whereas Solomon's talking about my wisdom. I tried to determine what was right. I had all of this. I built that. I built the other thing. And he came to the point where he says, well, at verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, that's Solomon. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. My margin has futility. Futility. The word Hebrew is hebel. It is also used as a vapor or a breath or emptiness. It's something transitory. Now, pride and ego are a vapor and a breath. They are empty. But there are a lot of other things. He goes on to say, all. is futility. All is empty. Everything is a breath. Is that true? Look, here was this man who had vast wealth. And it was all like the air in bread. It was all like that puffed up bread. It was just empty. And he could see that in this life. And as Mr. Horvath brought out, the problem was, he said, verse 3, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And then in verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. Verse 13, this grievous task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. And then he says, I looked at it. Verse 14, all the works that are done under the sun, indeed, it's all vanity and grasping for the wind. So the title of my sermon is Leaven and Vanity. Leaven and Vanity. You'd say, well, is everything empty? Look at all that Solomon had. He built the temple. Where is the temple he built? Can they even find one little piece of it and say, well, this is from Solomon's temple? The stones are there somewhere. They may be down in the Kidron Valley. You know, there is something left from that time that he built. He built a beautiful home. He built the hall of the Cedars of Lebanon. And David had saved all this gold and silver and stones and wood. And then Solomon got Cedars of Lebanon to come down, built this gorgeous temple, built himself a palace, and then married 1,000 women. Let me tell you, from the Bible, I've said, did he really remember all their names? And I've had people say, well, he was a smart guy. He could remember all their names. I couldn't have remembered all their names. But the examples that I see in the Bible, that everybody who had more than one wife paid the price. Can you imagine Solomon had 1,000, and he said, among 1,000 men, I can find one man who's honorable. But among 1,000 women, I can't. Well, Solomon, if you're married to him, of course not. If you've got 1,000 women all wanting your attention, all saying, well, you built her that house. My house isn't as good as hers. She got more clothes. She has more servants than I do. So he's trying to please 1,000 women. And all of them jealous of each other. This man, with all his wisdom, because he rejected God, became a fool. And he said, under heaven, this, what's life like? We'd all say, what a wonderful life he had. He built gardens and he had pools and he had all these works. By the way, there is something left that you can find that he built. If you go into the valley that is between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives, see, you know the Wailing Wall, which is the west wall, but you have to go to the east side to find anything left. The Wailing Wall is all Herod stones. You'd say, well, that's something of the temple. No, it wasn't the temple. It was just building up a flat area to put the temple on. See, you had a hill. Well, it's kind of hard, you know, with a hill. You put something on a hill, put the temple on a hill, and then it's all up. So they wanted a flat area. And then they built what they call porches. They aren't porches as you and I think of porches. They were like Greek porticos. And that is, they were just columns with a roof. And it was built around this flat area. So they had to get a big flat area. So those stones that are on the Wailing Wall were just there to hold the dirt and everything and stones and rocks so they'd have a flat temple area to put the temple on. And so they're still there. Well, from the original building of Solomon on the east side, way down at the bottom, you can find those stones. And the reason you know it's different is because Herod's temple, they dressed the edges of the stone with a little ridge. But the ones that are down, first ones on the bottom in that valley, were not dressed. So they weren't from, they were from before Herod's time, because Herod's stones are on top of that. So it's assumed that those were from Solomon when he built it, and he built up the big flat area on which to put. You know, that's it. That's it. His temple's gone. I'm sure he had a gorgeous place to bury him. Nobody knows where his burial site is. They don't know where David's buried. All of the kings had, you know, they would have this beautiful place where they were going to be buried. They don't know where any of them are. They're all gone. Solomon's gardens, there's nothing. It's all vanity. It was all air. It was all futility. Now, I would like, maybe some of you could think, what is there that we, that people think of as being important and yet is going to come to nothing? What is there? Any suggestions? Anybody want to make a suggestion as to something you think is vanity? It's going to come to nothing? Instagram likes. Right. I have never had anybody do an Instagram like for me. But then you know why. I've never done an Instagram. I've just, you know, somebody suggested we need bumper stickers that say, just say no to Facebook. So I would have one of those stickers if they had them on my bumper. That's right. All these likes that people have, I guess people want to have, and if you have, do they also do likes for tweets or what else? Also? Yeah. So a lot of people, they want more likes. And I guess you can make some money if you get enough because of the advertising that's on there. Okay. It's going to come to nothing. Absolutely. What else is vanity? Money is vanity. That's right. What is that paper worth? How many of you remember who it was that disconnected the dollar from gold? Back gold, yes. Nixon. That's right. A lot of you probably sympathize with Republicans. I think more church members do, although there are some who sympathize with Democrats. We had a gentleman, no longer alive, who was up in Bowling Green, and he was very much strong, opposed to Republicans. And he's not living now, but one time we had somebody from another church area. Stan Martin happened to be up there that Sabbath, and he saw a man he knew strongly sympathized with Republicans to go over and talk to this man who strongly sympathized with Democrats. Matter of fact, so much so he asked one of the pastors, is it okay if I give money to this charity? Man said, I forget which elder it was. Yeah, I suppose so. Why would you not? Well, George Bush's wife is on the board, so he didn't feel like he should give, maybe he shouldn't give money to it. But anyway, Stan Martin saw these two men come together, and he thought, oh man, this could really be fireworks if they start talking politics. So he immediately ran over to make sure that the conversation never got on to politics. That's right. Who gave away the Suez Canal? Anybody know? Who was it? Who made the ultimate decision to let Egypt take the Suez Canal? It was before. Eisenhower, that's correct. The French and the British wanted to fight. Well, it may have been later, but when Nasser, nationalized the Suez Canal, and the British and French wanted to fight. But Eisenhower refused to get involved and said no. Now, I was thinking, why would they have listened to him? But Eisenhower later, before he died, said it's the biggest mistake he ever made as president, was letting the Suez Canal go and not supporting the French and British in fighting Nasser. How many of you even remember Nasser? See, a minority. Okay. He was the dictator of Egypt at that time. I can say president. He was a dictator. So all of that ends up money. It is what is called a fiat currency. It's supported by the good faith and of the United States. That's it. Nothing else. Nothing else. Is it $20 trillion in debt now? So money. What is it going to be? Actually, money was worth something, you could say, when I was young. You could buy a Coca-Cola for a nickel, candy bar for a nickel. You could get a hamburger for a dime. Go back. Would have been better off not to have the Cokes and candy bars. But anyway, what else is vanity? A big car. How many of you have ever owned a new car? Was it nice? Huh? It has the new car smell. You know that there are some used car places, they actually can spray on a new car smell. That they will go in when they do the detailing to make it look like it's new. They can spray with a new car smell. So that new car smell, which actually they say is killing us, the paints and plastics and carpet of that new car smell, and the door shuts so nice. People love that. You shut the door and it has a nice, you don't have to keep banging to make it shut, and it doesn't rattle, and the transmission actually doesn't go. If it's automatic, it starts to shift from one to the other. Thunk. That shows the transmission, automatic transmission, is going. But wasn't it wonderful to have that new car? Where is that car? Where is it right now? Some of you may still be driving it, right? You're driving it. Okay. But how many of those cars went in and were chewed up and made into, you know, became something else? After a while, the doors don't shut so well. The transmission isn't working so well. The motor is pinging and clunking and giving you trouble, and maybe you have trouble starting. And after a while, you're just ready to get rid of that thing and trade in for a new car. So your car is empty. A new car is just vanity. It's futility. Now, I'm not saying don't get a new car. I'm just saying it's not going to last. It's not going to be a new car. It's going to get dents. And when you first get a new car, you got to keep it clean, keep it shiny. Back when I was young, we had to wax it. It's the only way to keep it. They didn't have clear coat on top. But we had to clean it and wax it. But after a while, it's just an old car. There's only so much you can do with an old car. And the paint has faded and given you trouble. So a car. What else is vanity? Pardon? A new home. How many of you have had a new home? Moved into a new home? Not everybody, a few folks. Or just moving into one that's new for you and is a little nicer. Where is that home going to be eventually? I've got pictures of me, brand new little boy, in Charleston, South Carolina, where I was born, on B Street. And it wasn't my parents' home. They were renting. It was right at the beginning of the... It was 1940 when I was born. And Dad went into the service right after that. He was asked to go into the service. So that home's completely gone. There's some sort of a fast food where that home... But I thought it, where they were renting, it was a beautiful-looking home. It was gorgeous. Probably they just had part of it. But it's gone. It's just totally gone. Now, I've got two homes that were owned by my great-grandfathers that are still there. But they're not going to last. They could burn up easily. Very easily. And they're just going to be gone. So, new home. What else is vanity? Yes, ma'am. Our physical bodies, she says. I don't know how many of you will remember, but I gave a sermon here some time ago, and I started off by saying, in order to be in God's kingdom, there are things we have to give up. One of the things you're going to have to give up is something you dearly love. You love it. You can say you don't. You love it. Well, maybe if it's giving you trouble like that old car, you're getting pretty upset with it. But still, you know, even if your body is like an old car and giving you trouble, you still do your best if you get cold to get warm. If you get too warm to cool off. If you get hungry to put food in you. If you get thirsty to put drink. But you know what? Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. You're going to have to get rid of that body if you're going to be in God's kingdom. You can't take it in God's kingdom with you. So that's true. Our bodies are vanity. They're just here for a moment. And then they're gone. Then they're gone. I was trying to think of the French actress who was... I brought a picture of her. She was so gorgeous. And then a now picture of her. Can't think of her name. Anybody? Brigitte Bardot. Yes. I have pictures of her. Did I show those pictures here? I did. I mean, they were pretty. Just looking at her, and I said, now you're going to wonder, why am I bringing this picture? Because, I mean, she looked pretty racy. She was called one of the sex kittens at that time. And then I showed a picture of her today. And here is this woman who was just the toast of Europe for a while, of France. Every man's desire. So, it doesn't last. And there are scriptures that tell us that in Proverbs 31, aren't there? What else is vanity? Wealth, having wealth. Exactly right. Pardon? Fame. Fame is a two-edged sword. I don't know. I'm not going to ask how many of you would like to be famous. But I'll tell you what. I can go into Kroger or Target or Publix. And it depends. Now, some groceries. I like the grocery stores where outside of the grocery store, it's a hill going down to your car. And poor Lucretia has seen me do this many a time. I'm coming out with a cart, and I'll get it aimed right, and I'll just jump up and stand on that bottom part, and down you go. And they don't tend to go straight. They tend to turn. And so I'm going like this, trying to keep it. And sometimes I have to put a foot down and straighten it out. But you know something? If I were famous, there'd be pictures. People would be noticing. I'd be the laughing stock. of the nation. Now I'm just the laughing stock of a few folks in the parking lot. And they're paying no attention. They don't know me. And that's such a pleasure to have a private life. A lot of these people live in a gilded cage. They can't just go out to dinner anywhere they want. George Jones, when he was alive and some people were visiting, and he went up to that restaurant that's going out of town, like you're going to Fairview. What's the name of that, Tom? Pardon? Loveless, yes. Loveless Cafe. We did a funeral out there one time. I did a funeral. I think that might have been Mr. Ferris's mother. Didn't I do your mother's funeral out there? I think I rode with the funeral director and his assistant in the hearse. They said, ride with us. And on the way back, they wanted to stop at the Loveless Cafe, but they had somebody visiting George Jones. They were doing a little filming of it. And that man could not eat his meal at the Loveless Cafe. There were just constant people coming over and bothering him. See, I could go to the Loveless Cafe, which I have no interest in doing. But I can go to a restaurant, nobody bothers me. You know, I can have some privacy. Yeah, fame, it isn't going to last. And if it does last, it's a curse. What else is vanity? Hair? Yeah? Hair? That's right. Yeah. Well, let me just go through a few things. For instance, I mentioned, and here are some of the things that I put down, and you've covered some of these, your life and your health. Your health is vanity. Why? Because it's just a breath. It is not going to last. You are not going to stay that healthy young individual. And you know, you can be young, like poor Lisa Shrewsbury. Hope you're praying for Lisa. Or maybe a lot of, I don't know why, I sent out a prayer request for Yvonne Nduka. How many of you got that prayer request? Maybe that's it. Yvonne over, cancer has returned. Back over, you know, I think you, I'm going to have to resend that. I sent the picture of her. If you remember, oh, about 7 years ago, there was this poor girl, 13 years old, who was so embarrassed because she just was twice the height of the other kids. I mean, she was really tall and slim, and she had a size 13 shoe, which she could not get a women's size 13 shoe. Remember, we collected those size 13 women's shoes. We sent them to the home office, and they included them in a shipment of booklets that they were sending to Nigeria. And then shortly after that, Yvonne's mother, who seemed perfect health, dropped dead. And she was a deaconess, her husband the deacon in Benin City congregation. We don't have any elders there. So they really were the leaders. I mean, Agnes Nduka, Yvonne's mother, was just wonderful, balanced lady. And she just was gone. And then, a couple of years ago, Yvonne got breast cancer. And they took off both of her breasts. And now the cancer has returned. She's 20 years old and bedridden. 20 years old. I mean, you don't know her, but I do. I do know her. I tried to send. You didn't get the picture. I sent it out and I kept getting returns. So I need to send it again. Just to remind you what Yvonne looked like. 20 years old and little. What is it? Lisa Shrewsbury had that tumor in her brain. They couldn't get it all. They said it's malignant. Well, favor is Proverbs 31, verse 30. If you are healthy, good. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. And another one, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8. I'll just read it. For while, and this is the Revised Standard Version, for while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. So building up your body, your body's going to give out. It's just not going to keep going. It's going to be gone. So if we look, that's your body, your health is vanity. Not that it's bad. I don't mean, it's not going to last. Okay, 8 minutes. Your position and job. The job you have, your position. Interestingly enough, your position in the church, if you happen to be a deacon or a, think of this, may, our teaching may actually cause you to have a lower position in God's kingdom. Because it says, James chapter 3 verse 1, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing, and actually teachers is the word, knowing we shall receive the greater condemnation, Revised Standard Version. Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, for you know that we who teach shall be judged with greater strictness. Who's going to be judged most of all for that sermonette? The guy who gave it. You teach others? Did you learn it? Me for the sermon. Your possessions. It's another one I have. 2 Peter 3 verse 10. 2 Peter 3 verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Your knowledge. What you and I know, knowledge puffs up. Didn't we read that? Is it possible the fact that you and I know about Easter and Christmas and the day of the sun, and we also know about Passover and days of unleavened bread, could that puff us up at all? Could that puff us up a little bit that we know what they don't know? See? I want to turn to Psalm 39 verses, start in verse 4. Psalm 39. In telling you that everything is vanity, there are some things that are not empty. God's Spirit. See, Solomon said everything's vanity, but he wasn't working with God's Spirit. Jesus Christ in us is not vanity. That's something that can last forever. God's love is not vanity, it lasts. But the greatest of these is love, because it lasts. So there are some things that are good. We just have to be careful that we don't let all the things of this, where your family is vanity. By the way, I don't own my children. I say my children. They are my children. But they belong to God. Lucretia doesn't belong to me. I'm married to her, but she belongs to God. She's always belonged to God. So our families, they're not going to last. I hope Lucretia is my companion forever. But she won't be my wife. She'll be one of the guys. Right? Be neither male nor female. Won't marry in the kingdom, Jesus said. But here in Psalm 39, beginning in verse 4, Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am? Indeed, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my ages as nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. There you go. Hebel. Just vanity. I think the King James has vanity there. But it's just vapor. All of you. Even these healthy young people in the front row over here on my left. They're your right. They're just vapor. They won't last. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. There is hope. There is something that lasts. My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Boy, is that something that can be worthwhile. Being forgiven. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ that God the Father gave for all of us. That Jesus gave for all of us. Do not make me the reproach of the foolish. I was mute. I did not open my mouth because it was you who did it. Remove your plague from me. I am consumed by the blow of your hand. We all receive troubles and trials in this life. They're only temporary. When with rebukes you correct man for iniquity, you make his beauty melt away like a moth. Just going to be gone. Surely every man is vapor. Hey, that's, think of that. Jesus is not vapor. God's spirit is not vapor. But humanly, everything we see or touch, everything physical. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner as all my fathers were. We're just here for a moment. Remove your gaze from me that I may regain strength before I go away and am no more. So let's focus on God the Father and Jesus Christ and His Spirit. It's something that lasts.